This is an ABC podcast.
Neil Johansen is an architect, and when Neil hit his 30s, he felt the urge to attempt something dramatic and challenging, so he became a mountaineer. The life became sort of addictive, and Neil eventually scaled the 7 great summits of the world, including Everest. Then on April 25, 2015, Neil and his wife Dinah were leading a group of army veterans near Everest Base Camp when a 7.8 magnitude earthquake hit the roof of the world, creating landslides and avalanches all around them. It was the biggest earthquake in that region for more than 8 decades, and it destroyed whole villages. And this meant that Neil and his group had to find their way out amid scenes of terrible devastation. And like everyone who lived through it, Neil had to question the way he thought about the earth beneath his feet. Hello, Neil.
G'day.
Tell me about the expedition you were leading on that day in 2015. What was the nature of it?
I had a couple of mates, ex-paratroopers, and they approached me and said, we've got this idea to take a group of people to Everest Base Camp to commemorate Anzac Day. It was 100 years since the Anzacs had landed in the Dardanelles. And they had put together a group of people who had members of their families serving, had served themselves, or had relatives who'd actually landed at Gallipoli, and thought wouldn't it be a great thing to do to gather these group of people together, go to base camp and have that ceremony, and asked me if I could participate that and help guide that team to base camp.
Okay, so you have this group of people, and how many did you have?
Oh, it was a dozen people.
A dozen people or so. Yeah. So what happened with that plan to take them up to base camp? What happened on the day of the ceremony then?
Well, we had been trekking for around about 10 days. Base camp was the turnaround point. And we had made what turned out to be a very fateful decision to relocate the point of the ceremony from base camp to a lower altitude because the weather was about to turn and we didn't want to get stuck at base camp because if there was a whiteout, we would have some big problems.
So it was going to snow quite heavily then?
It was going to snow really heavily to the point where we wouldn't be out, we'd become disoriented and we wouldn't know how to get back. So we thought, let's go to base camp really early, get that out of the way, and take some lovely photographs, and we'd identified a spot at a slightly lower altitude where we thought it would be perfect to have the commemorative ceremony.
And what was the ceremony like?
Oh, it was really somber. We made a small rock chortland. We had the...
What is that? Sorry?
It's a little pile of rocks.
Right.
It's a way in Nepal of marking places of significance. And so we had the chortland made. Some of the Sherpas that we were with made that. We all had poppies that some of the people on the trip had crocheted. And we had the Australian flag and the Aboriginal flag as well. And we had a reading and the last post was played. It was a very somber moment. It was lightly snowing. And we were all in a very reflective mood. The ceremony completed. And then we, a few hours later, decided to take a break at the next tea house, and that's when everything changed.
What happened when you got there?
Well, we sat down and we were kind of relaxed. These tea houses are really quite ancient structures, and you sit in a big room and on the edges and everybody's looking at each other, and we're just relaxing, feeling pretty good about the day. And suddenly there was this rumbling. And I thought somebody had left the spin dryer on. It was kind of a sound that you associate with at home. And then to me, the spin dryer was getting louder and louder and louder. And then the building started vibrating. And suddenly your mind switches from this can't be a tumble dryer. There's no way it could be that noisy. To maybe this is an earthquake.
And so how violently was the tea house shaking?
Well, everything's moving around. Things are bouncing off the table. Furniture is starting to fall over. Dust is starting to fall from the ceiling above. And we realized then that this was a problem and ran out of the building. And I think when we ran out of the building back into the open area, it was pretty obvious something quite dramatic was unfolding. The birds in the sky were going bonkers, and there were yaks and donkeys running around like crazy. And then we started to see real evidence of the earthquake. And we're on one side of a valley, and directly in front of us was the main range of the Himalayas. And the peaks at that point are 6,500 to 7,000 meters, so they're pretty tall-looking mountains, snow-capped and really sharp, made of rock. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing in front of me. These gigantic monoliths were starting to vibrate and sway like a palm tree in a breeze.
What, a Himalayan mountain?
A Himalayan mountain range that was stretching as far as you could see, moving. And that was a very, very disconcerting moment for us. In the meantime, so this went for maybe about 60 seconds, and then things started to calm down, and we began to kind of regroup and compose ourselves and kind of talk about just what had happened and what the likelihood of something else happening was going to be.
I've never lived through an earthquake. Certainly nothing, maybe the odd tremor, but nothing as violent as that. The only thing I've seen like it is in a movie. Mm. What does the reality of an earthquake mean compared to what we'd see in a movie? What do you get in that we're not seeing in the movies?
Well, you get fear. You hear all the sounds. This horrible, deep, guttural sound that's coming somewhere deep from within the earth, ricocheting up and down the valley. So you get this kind of echoing effect. So it's a strange kind of reverb. So the whole thing is being amplified. So it's really loud.
And really low as well?
Like a very low resonance.
What about the earth beneath your feet?
Earth beneath the feet is, it's kind of moving around. You're feeling like you're losing your balance. You can't run because where you're about to put your foot isn't kind of where you thought it was going to be. So the earth is kind of shaking around as well. So the sound, the vibration, and then all the visible evidence of things starting to fall over and break down. And what cuts right through all of that are people screaming in fear of their life. And those two things together are very difficult to take in all at the same time.
I'm just thinking, if it's as you described there, I suppose if I was there, I'd be thinking, I've got to run away, but then you can't. There's nothing to run to. And what you're running on is the problem.
There's no safe place. I mean, where do you run to? There are boulders running down the mountain. We're on the edge of a very sharp valley. You can't kind of just parachute into the valley. You don't know if the earthquake's moving to your left, your right, if it's getting bigger or subsiding. And I think that's another concern. It's not, on top of the sound, there's that sense of helplessness. And I think that's the thing that people struggle with most of all. All control is stripped away from you. You're just standing there, unable to control things. And if you're a controlling person like I am, that's a really difficult thing to deal with.
Do you feel like a fly speck, in a way?
Oh, yeah, you feel totally insignificant. When the earth wants to, make a big deal and put on a good show, there's absolutely nothing you can do about it.
So you were standing on the edge of a ravine and a valley, and up, and then the mountains were rearing up behind that. Did that mean whatever was tumbling down the mountains was sort of being caught in this valley, or more or less, or is that too simple?
No, I think the a lot of debris was going down into the valley below us, which was probably 600 or 700 meters. So if you were in the valley, you would have been caught up in a series of landslides, and that would have had as was the case for a lot of people in Nepal, they perished because of the landslides.
How devastated were these settlements in that area?
Well, at the time, we didn't quite understand the magnitude of this earthquake. We thought it was fairly localized to the immediate region, and it wasn't until we continued our descent back to firstly Namche Bazaar and then finally to Lukla, which is where you fly back to Kathmandu, that we started to see more and more evidence of the earthquake. to get to base camp is a 10-day hike, and every day you stay in a little village. And they're kind of, you know, equally spaced out. Lovely, charming villages, full of fantastically friendly and caring people. Every place that we'd stayed at was damaged to varying degrees. So every tea house, every building was showing some evidence of destruction. Now, in some cases, it was maybe a couple of windows that had popped out. In other cases, the roof had caved in and the building was just in rubble. And all the people that we'd been engaging with all the way up were standing completely perplexed, you know, really struggling to come to terms with what had happened. And we were just walking through this. We were just kind of cruising through all this devastation, a little bit like zombies. You know, what could we do to help?
What about Everest Base Camp, where you were headed that day and didn't reach?
Well, that was the really distressing thing. We didn't understand until a couple of days later that earthquake had triggered an enormous avalanche. And I'm sure many people have seen the footage taken on a little GoPro of the impact that avalanche had. So that really devastated a base camp, and I think there were about 36 fatalities as a result of that. The thing that I've always struggled with is that's where we were going to have our Anzac Day commemorative event. And in fact, the place where we were going to do it is where two Sherpas that I'd climbed with had been killed.
Oh,
so I know that if we hadn't made a good call, we would have got caught up in that avalanche. So for the rest of the time, back to Namche, and I think this is when we first realised that something really bad had happened at base camp, was when the helicopter started ferrying the bodies of the dead climbers up and down the valley.
When was it that you decided you wanted to start climbing big things, like huge mountains?
No, the first thing I decided I wanted to climb was a tree in our backyard, which I thought was pretty big at 12. And then I progressed through bigger and bigger trees. And I think all the way through school, I loved abseiling and climbing and jumping down into caves, doing all those kind of typical outdoor type things. And it was some time until I thought maybe there's something grander that I could do.
Something bigger than trees?
Bigger than trees. And, you know, I got married, I had a couple of kids. So all those sorts of activities went on hold for many years. And it wasn't until I got into my late 30s that I thought maybe now's the time and I've got the means to start thinking about something even greater. And over a couple of bottles of red wine with a mate of mine called Andrew Sargent, we started thinking about what the future might look like. And we went through a number of different scenarios. We thought about pushing a lawnmower across Australia. And
what?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it had never been done. And then
still to this day, I believe.
It's still, right. Richard, do you want to go push a lawnmower?
Right, okay.
You'll be the first. And then we contemplated learning how to scuba dive and go under the ice caps, you know, a bunch of kind of harebrained things. But we actually settled on learning how to climb Mount Cook in New Zealand. And we thought that would be a really good thing to get ourselves healthy, stop drinking as much red wine as we did, and learn some skills that, you know, we just didn't have. And that set us on this, on a pathway. And 2 years later, we flew off to New Zealand with the intention of climbing Mount Cook.
So that's a 2-year process then of getting fit and learning how to climb mountains and going step by step before you're ready to take on something like Mount Cook. But how did that go then once you arrived in New Zealand?
Well, it all went pretty well. We'd done our homework and our training in the Blue Mountains. We spent most of that time learning how to climb. With a great guy over there called Adam Dara, and he said, look, I'll take you to New Zealand. And with a mate of his, Marty, the four of us formed this team. We thought, okay, let's do this. And when we got to New Zealand, we flew out of Wanaka and landed on the Tasman Glacier and started our prep work. You just don't arrive and climb Mount Cook. You've got to get oriented. And we did a few practice runs. which were pretty good. And then we thought, well, we'll give Mount Green a bit of a crack while we're here.
Like a training mountain type
thing. It's a training mountain. So the four of us headed off early in the morning when the snow is reasonably compact and the ice is pretty secure from, you know, the tools that we use. And we got to this particular part. We were climbing up in a couloir, which is like a semi-circular ravine, going fairly well straight up. We had about 200 metres of vertical climbing to do, and we're using our ice axe and our picks in our hands, and we're kicking our boots into the ice with our crampons on to get purchase. So it's pretty straight up. And then you'd make the switch onto the ridge line, and half an hour later you'd be on the summit. So we're well into this, and the weather is fantastic, and we're feeling great, feeling strong, which is really important, and emotionally, you know, right on. And then this really kind of strange thing happened. I'd never seen it before, but we heard this very faint sound, like kind of a squeaking talcum powdery rubbing sound. Like if you walk on the sand at Jervis Bay, it squeaks. And it sounded just like that. And as we looked to our left, we could see this very fine fissure starting to open up on the side of this mountain.
What, the mountain's opening up?
The mountain is opening up, and it's getting wider and wider and wider. So we have a straight line, which is in line with us, about 300 metres to our left, and it's heading directly towards us. And as it's getting closer, it's opening up to the point where it's 5 or 6 metres wide, and at that point, all the snow and ice that is on the lower side of that decides to give way and dislocates from the mountain, and tens of thousands of tons of snow and ice just lets loose and heads down towards the Tasman Glacier.
Now, is this happening above you or beside you?
This is in eye level with us.
Right.
And the gap is getting bigger and more snow and ice is falling away from us. And my friend Andrew Adam are in line to be collected by this bigger gap, at which point I thought, well, that's the end of that trip. And very fortunately, everything came to a rest quite literally 10 metres from where they were.
Oh.
So that was really quite a disconcerting moment and not really what we had in the playbook for going up Mount Cook. All the while this is happening, we're getting hit by a shockwave, blasts of snow and ice, and the pressure wave from that nearly knocked us off our feet.
What do you mean? There's what?
Well, just the air pressure that changed because suddenly all the stuff's being pushed in one direction pushed this kind of wave of air.
Like an explosion, then.
Yeah, it's like a exactly, bomb going off. Yeah, it's like a bomb. Exactly. It's a good description. Good way of describing it. So
you're clinging to the side of your quote-unquote practice mountain.
Yeah.
Clinging to the side of this thing, being sort of blasted by this pressure dislocation.
Yeah.
And all this snow and ice is eventually come hurtling down the mountain, come to a rest 10 metres away from your friends.
Yeah. So there's not much of the mountain left to climb after that.
No. So that's that. So what happened when it came to a rest? What did you do?
Well, we just looked at each other in complete disbelief. And in a very matter-of-fact way, said, well, maybe we should just go back to the hut now. And
it's like a warning from a god or something. It seems the fact that it's arrested itself 10 meters away from you would you'd have to think that this is some kind of some vengeful god throwing down something at you and saying, now learn your lesson from that.
Yeah. I didn't learn my lesson.
No.
Went back for more. But we just headed back to one of the camping huts. All our gear we'd left a whole lot of gear down below the couloir, and that had all disappeared under the avalanche. When we got back to the hut, other climbers in the hut applauded because they just didn't think we were going to be returning from that little foray into the mountains. And we just, and I think when we sat down and had a cup of tea and reflected upon what had taken place only a few hours beforehand, we realised just how big a deal that was and how close to a disaster for us that could have been. So we took the next day off, and Andrew and I had quite a few conversations about what we should do next. And the next day, the weather was absolutely fantastic. There was no one else planning to climb Mount Cook. And so we had a conversation around what we were going to do. And I'd said to Andrew, look, if Marty and Adam are still up for it, I'm prepared to give it a go. And he said, I on reflection, I'd rather not. I think we reacted to that in two different ways, and I totally respect him for the decision that he made.
Did he have kids?
Yeah, he's got a young boy, and
so he decided he didn't want to deprive them of a father.
I think it shook us up, and he just made a good decision. You know, on the mountains, you make life and death decisions all the time. And that was one that he made.
And you went up Mount Cook anyway.
Yeah, I went up with Marty and Adam, and we spent the next 16 hours making our way all the way up to the top and then back down again. I mean, the top of Mount Cook is remarkable. You can see from the east coast to the west coast. It's an absolutely beautiful place. And I was up there with just the two other guys, and it was beautiful and calm, completely unlike the day before. And I felt that's when I got hooked.
In many ways, you could say your friend Andrew made the sensible decision. Like I said, he's got a family.
Yeah.
So he decided not to try.
Yeah.
But why did you decide to go ahead anyway?
I guess I got very good at setting aside things, setting aside emotions, setting aside fear. I'm also very single-minded, and I thought, we're here to do this. I really want to do this.
Come all this way.
Yeah, and it couldn't possibly happen again. It's not going to happen to me is just self-delusion. It could easily happen to you. So I just, put all that stuff into a little box and up I went.
So having arrived at the summit of Mount Cook, and
yeah.
Is that as satisfying as you'd imagined it would be?
Oh, phenomenal. Phenomenal to be in that kind of rarefied environment, to do something that not a lot of people have done, to have achieved something that is a clear demonstration that you had, that everything that you did, all the planning that you did, was a success. Gave me a great thrill. I was fit, the gear was correct, the weather was fantastic, I was healthy, made all the right moves, mitigated as many risks as I could, and then got there. It just was like, wow, it all just lined up beautifully.
So how long is the interval then from that feeling to the next one, which is, let's do something different, something else, let's do another mountain?
I think the intervals get closer and closer together.
While you're coming down the mountain, or
well, I think a few weeks later, I'm starting to think about what to do next, and that involved going to Nepal.
Doing the seven summits, the seven summits,
something that had been in the back of my mind for a long, long time. But I'm a great believer in articulating something only when you're prepared to commit. Because this act of saying I'm going to do something
is very serious, isn't it?
It's hyper serious. So the seventh summit wasn't something that I started leaning towards until after Mount Everest. So the next step for me was to get into Nepal and climb something significantly higher, up into between the 5,000 and 6,000 meter range. And so I started formulating a plan around climbing something called Amar Balam. And at that point, I thought if I achieve that, maybe that would be, I'd be probably pretty happy with that. But then there's, you're feeding the beast.
Feeding the beast, yeah. And are those seven summits all in the Himalayas, or are they in the Andes as well?
They're the highest mountains on each continent.
Oh, okay.
So you have, Europe, North and South America, Africa, the Antarctic, Australia.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
You eventually did decide to commit to climbing Mount Everest and then the Seven Summits. Once you were coming down from Mount Everest, tell me what happened to your right hand.
We got back to the highest camp on Mount Everest, which is called the South Col. And that's the first time you get to have a bit of a breather. We'd actually left Camp 3 the day before, got to the South Col, had an hour's rest, went up to the summit and back down again. And that total cycle took 36 hours. So it's 36 hours without any sleep, two or three meals, and only a few litres of water. So by the time we got back to having a rest, I was pretty exhausted. Fell asleep. I was in the tent with our expedition leader and another climbing partner, and woke up a few hours later, gagging for air, actually. The oxygen that I'd been on had run out. So I was feeling, I wasn't feeling very well. In fact, I was hypoxic. And the expedition leader, David Hamilton, thought, oh, gee, we better, you know, we haven't checked each other out. We better have a look at, you know, how we're going, check for signs of frostbite. So off with boots, checking all the toes, feet. And I was the last person to be checked over. And as I pulled off my right mitten, and you've got layers and layers of gloves on, I thought, man, there's something not right here. And took off the big puffy glove and then the inner glove and then the inner glove. And then I've got a little silk glove that's just over my hand. And as that came off, I could see my hand, which was now white. And three of the fingers were frozen solid.
What, like popsicles?
Just like popsicles. And no feeling. The hand's like rigid. And I couldn't believe it, so I actually tapped my fingers against my ice axe, which was lying next to me in my sleeping bag, and it was making this tinny sound, and I thought, that's really odd. And it wasn't until David looked at my hand and said, mate, that's a really bad case of frostbite. We need to attend to this straight away, that I thought, well, I've got off the summit. I'm at the South Col. I'm still 3,000 kilometres above, Earth. Got up here. Getting up here was hard enough with two hands. How am I going to get back with one? And that just set about a whole chain reaction of things that were necessary to look after my injury and get me back safe and sound.
And as you got down the mountain and your fingers started to thaw, what did they look? How did they start to change?
Well, then the feeling started coming back into my finger, into my hands. You can't be medicated at that altitude. You'll make some silly decisions. So it wasn't until we got back to base camp and unwrapped everything that my now defrosted hand was starting to show all the hallmarks of bad frostbite. So the enormous blisters and black fingers.
Right, so it went from white to black, in other words,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. So there was clearly an awful lot of damage.
Once you finally got back to Sydney, what state was your hand in then?
Well, by that stage, I was put onto morphine straight away because the pain was quite acute. The hand was kind of fairly mangled and unrecognisable, and I was taken to a hand specialist at the Royal North Shore, who also knew a lot about burns. And I had my view on things, but his advice was, let's give it a week and see what happens. Otherwise, we might start to be amputating some of those fingers. And we went back to that doctor every 3 weeks for a year to get a determination on just how much of my fingers would be amputated. And he encouraged patience, and I think that was a good decision because at the end of the day, I only ended up having a small amount of one of the fingers amputated.
Did this lead to a kind of discussion, though? I mean, I'm sure your wife had a view on this. You know, you.
No, she wasn't. She wasn't very happy about all of that at all. I mean, towards the end of that, I actually got the Leatherman out, and I thought, well, if Renu Fines can cut off the top of his finger, well, maybe I can as well. I was telling her about this and what I just tried, and she freaked out. So that actually, I think that was a kind of a fairly strange but cathartic moment where after a year of recovering from Mount Everest, it was time to have a conversation between ourselves about how she felt about the experiences that I'd had and the fact that I wasn't really kind of connecting with her. And so that started a process of intense self-reflection.
Is it a bit addictive? I mean, and I know addiction is used as a kind of an easy metaphor, but it just seems like have all those things, like you invest so much of yourself in pursuit of this thing to the exclusion of all other things, at enormous risk to your health, the disregard for the people around you. Is that where you ended up in all this?
It is highly addictive. In fact, I think I was probably more possessed than addicted.
Possessed? Like almost like a little voice.
Get up that other mountain. Yeah, keep going. But I think it's a very strange world that you inhabit when you have this single focus. I think I had tunnel vision for 7 or 8 years at the exclusion of just about everything else. And unfortunately, my wife, Dinah, who was the person closest to me, who provided the most amount of support, was probably the person who was on the very periphery of that tunnel vision. And that wasn't a good place to be.
You can go adventuring, but does it always have to be heroic, I suppose? Where did you end up in all this with your discussions with her?
I don't think the experience that we had is limited to being a mountaineer. I think if you're pursuing any kind of sporting activity, for example, or you could be an obsessive artist or an obsessive poet, the common thread here is a single-mindedness and an obsession at the exclusion of everybody else. And I don't know whether you need to be that single-minded. I'll tell you this, a very quick story. It's called The Pebble. My GP, Stephen List, is an absolutely wonderful guy, and we're good friends. And he'd helped craft this health program, mental and emotional health program for me to get ready for Everest. And the day before I pushed off, we were just checking blood pressures and practical things, and he said, I want to give you something. And he used to wear this little waistcoat, and out of the top pocket of his waistcoat, he pulled out this little red velvet bag, and out of that came this little pebble. And I thought, oh, what's this? Where's this all heading? And he just pushed it into my hand and said, I want you to take this with you. And my first reaction was, well, that weighs a lot. It's only 200 grams. I don't want to carry that. I've stripped everything out of my pack. I gave it back to him and said, no, Stephen, I don't want this pebble. Please keep the pebble. He said, no, that's your pebble to take. And I walked out of the surgery, and my first reaction was, I'll just leave the pebble at home. And then I thought, what if I lose the pebble? And I'm getting in sixes and sevens over this until I meet a friend for breakfast, a guy called Marco, and I'm telling him the story about the pebble. And he said, well, why do you think he gave you the pebble? And I said, I have no idea. And he said, I'll tell you why he gave you the pebble, and that's because he wants you to give the pebble back. He wants you to come back from this trip. So stop being so, have this tunnel view, stop thinking entirely about yourself, start thinking about what's going to happen when you come back. And that was a really kind of, prophetic moment for me. I just thought, let's hold on to that moment and reconnect that when I get back from Mount Everest.
So then fast forward now to 2015 and that trip you took to the Himalayas, to Everest, intending to go to Everest Base Camp with the group for the Anzac Day ceremony. Mm. Your wife was with you there. Mm. Had she sort of agreed to sort of come with you now on your adventure?
I think it was great that Dinah wanted to have a look at Mount Everest and get a sense of the things that I'd experienced over there. She was also genuinely interested in the stories that all the people on our trip would be able to tell. She's also an artist, so she was very interested in sketching in that area. And it was something that we just thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to do together? Great part of the world, great culture to immerse yourself in. And so we went over there thinking we were going to have the holiday of a lifetime.
And then the earthquake hits.
Yeah.
7.8 magnitude earthquake hits, and everything comes tumbling down the mountains.
Yeah.
And there's mass destruction and the like. And you have to lead this party back down again. After the earthquake had hit, and you were leading this party back down again, did you anticipate there would be an aftershock?
No, we had no idea. We didn't know that quite literally in that moment 9,000 people had died. We had no comms. We just thought it was a relatively isolated incident. It wasn't until the next day, and around about the same time, that we were hit by the second aftershock. And that was actually more disconcerting, more terrifying, because when that happened and we were further down the track, we were in a much more exposed area. We weren't in a tea house. We're on a very narrow part of the track.
Is this a track carved out the side of the mountain?
Carved out of the side of the mountain. And so we were just walking along thinking, wow, we've dodged a really big bullet. And then the tremor started building again. And this time there was no doubt about it. We were in another earthquake was starting to unfold. And that one was quite terrifying because parts of the track were starting to give way and huge amounts of debris, large boulders, car-sized boulders were coming down the mountain, and there was nowhere to run other than to just tuck yourself in as closely to the bank as possible and hope that anything that came rolling down the hill would bounce over us. And that's, you know, I was just trying to help people get into that position in order to, avoid being injured.
How are you? Are you having to shout this? Because this is amidst tremendous noise, I'm
guessing. It's cupping the hands around your mouth and barking out these words.
And were people doing what you're asking? Were they just pushing themselves into the bank?
Yes, and when if someone wasn't able to hear me, it was just running up there and helping a person back into that position. All of this was happening at a bend in the track. So from where I was standing, I could look down one ravine and I could look down another ravine. And just trying to help direct people to ensure that they were in the safest possible position.
And did anyone panic?
Yeah, there was one of the guys who was further up the track who came running back towards me because his father, who was guiding on the trip as well, was further down the track. And he just wanted to be with his father. You know, in this horrible moment, they wanted to be together. The problem was between the two of us and his father were several hundred meters worth of track that was starting to dislodge. And he was hell-bent on getting back there. So I quite literally tackled him to the ground and lay over him and said, look, we just need to stay here. This is the safest. Your dad's going to be fine. Your dad's going to be fine. I just said that over and over to him. And then, just like the first earthquake, it just all stopped. And then you have this pause of deadly silence. There's still a few boulders rolling down the hill, and then there's absolute silence. And then as the dust is starting to kind of settle, people are standing up and shuffling around and yelling out, are you okay? Are you okay?
And what had happened to the track? Is the track still there?
Parts of it are there, and other parts have simply slid further into the ravine. And another one of these kind of sliding door moments. We were very fortunately on parts of the track that were okay. And the father and the son were reunited. And then we decided to keep going down to Namche Bazaar, which was one of the larger villages. And that's where we met all the Sherpa people who had come out of their village up to the high ground. Into what was becoming basically a little refugee camp, and trying to take stock of what to do next.
What state was the village in?
Wasn't in too bad a shape, actually. It's a major tourist destination. So many of the buildings there are more recent in construction. And so it hadn't fared too badly.
And how did they receive you once you arrived in there, everyone feeling a bit shell-shocked and fragile?
Well, this was the most remarkable thing, Richard. We gathered on the sports field with all the other members of the Namche community. Everybody had emptied out of their houses and we're all together. There are hundreds of us. And, of course, we'd lost all our food and water in the melee and feeling pretty sorry for ourselves. And the Sherpa people on the spot just started cooking food, making tea, making shelter available to us, providing comfort to us. I mean, we're the ones who should have been providing comfort to them because they'd, you know, their community was in a state of shock as well. So it was this incredibly remarkable moment when we were being helped by these people who had significantly less than us.
So once you then got back to Kathmandu, the capital of Nepal, what state was the city in when you got there?
Well, it was that was the first time the full devastation of the earthquake dawned on us because we could see it. We arrived at nighttime. By that stage, we knew that thousands and thousands of people in Kathmandu had been killed. The air was thick with ash because people needed to be cremated, and that was happening in the streets. So it was a terribly distressing place to be. You know, our destination was get to the High Commission. That's where we'd been directed by DFAT, because we knew that's where there would be food, where there would be water, and where the High Commission could assist us in getting back to Australia. So,
given that Kathmandu is a fair way from Everest Base Camp, does that suggest that almost the whole of Nepal was shaken by this earthquake?
A very, very large part of the country was, and from the initial earthquake to when we arrived in the High Commission, there were 90 other tremors. So, when you try to get some sleep, every few hours you can hear this vibration through the ground. So we never really slept from the first earthquake until we finally got on a flight to go back home. You are never able to relax. We've had this kind of horrible experience that's created enormous doubt in your mind about whether the earth is going to open up again. And to this day, I'm still not confident. When you experience an earthquake, the way I describe it to some people, it's like an alien just arrived in the studio and introduced himself, or him or her or whatever gender the alien has, are introduced to you. You kind of go, well, that is the most bizarre, unexpected, unimaginable thing. That's what an earthquake is like. You just cannot imagine that the crust that we stand on can be subject to such huge upheaval.
So it feels so unnatural. It's almost supernatural.
Yeah.
In a way.
And it's inexplicable.
And even now, you don't. What you're only ever at any given moment, like 95 to 98% certain of the ground you're standing on.
Yeah, I don't trust it. And that's a hard thing to live with.
Is that a common thing? Do you understand
that people go through that? I'm not sure if it's a common thing. I think it's probably part of, I think it's probably a remnant of a post-traumatic stress disorder. There are lots of symptoms associated with that. But I think...
Do you wake in the night with sweats and that sort of thing?
Not so much with the earthquake. I mean, I've taken a few decent falls in my time, and I've fallen in a few crevasses, and those things upset me even more, by the way. But I think probably when you amalgamate all those experiences, deep in the subconscious is something saying, watch out, be careful, don't trust everything.
Don't trust everything because just Yeah, everything you think is reliable isn't exactly 100% reliable.
No, no, no. People are okay, but they're kind of
the ground?
The ground, that's different. Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive.
Well, yeah, because the ground was unreliable, but the people were brilliant.
Yeah.
That's kind of like normally backwards, isn't it?
Most people, I don't know how often you can talk about this, but most people in a disaster perform pretty well. You know, they fall into a couple of groups. One is, tell me what I need to do. You know, I'm here, and you direct me. I don't care what you say. I'll do whatever you tell me to keep me safe. Then you have people who, and there's really the minority of people who hard to manage, trying to control something that just can't be controlled, and that kind of expresses itself in all kinds of strange ways. And it takes a lot of management to deal with that.
I've seen that happen in a very minor level after a major, major epic storm when half the trees in the neighbourhood fell down. Mm. People were brilliant. They got out and automatically cooperated, clearing roadblocks, but a couple of people just completely in the area freaked out entirely. Yeah. And that was really interesting to behold, actually. But by and large, people were quite wonderful. Well, then tell me then about this schools program you've become involved when it comes to the Himalayas.
You know, I got Peter Hillary, who's Ed Hillary's son, was also taking a group of people up to base camp, and we kept on intersecting at various points. So Peter and I kind of struck up a bit of a relationship. So he was the obvious person to call when I got back to Australia because I just felt I had to do something. He's involved in the Australian Himalayan Foundation. And they've got very strong links into the Sulukumbu region, which is that part of Nepal that was worst affected. And he said to me, well, what can you do? And I said, well, you know, we specialise in corporate office interiors. And he said, I don't think there's a great need for corporate office interiors. What else do you do? And I said, well, we build a lot of schools. He said, that's what we need help with. And so we were assigned a school in a region called Garma, and worked with the foundation and an NGO called Reed to master plan that school, which is badly damaged. We worked with other architects and engineers and essentially replan that to make it earthquake resistant and along the way a much better school for the kids.
So in other words, make it more like Japan, I suppose, that where most nearly all the buildings there are earthquake resistant.
Yeah, make it a safe haven.
Yeah.
But also point the building so they could take advantage of the prevailing breezes, give them windows, harvest the water. You know, really basic things that we take for granted here are still not common practice in Nepal. And it was at the end of that, and I was there a year ago to open that, it was at the end of that we also committed to building a community hall. And that's something that, you know, we opened a couple of weeks ago.
It'd be a really corny thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. Mm. But does doing is that a much better? I don't know. Is that a good substitute for wanting to climb mountains to open up a nice school that's earthquake proof and it's great for the kids and a community hall?
Oh, it's far more inclusive. I got to tell you that it's enormously satisfying, and it is something that you can share with others. You can get other people enthusiastic about it to raise money and to directly participate. And to see 350 kids enjoying a school that's safer, to work with local communities, to have the government, Nepalese government, come on board is just fantastic. And it's gone a long way to ameliorate some of my other, desires to go out and do crazy things. So climbing mountains has probably tempered a bit since the last trip, but it hasn't gone away.
What an amazing story, Neil. Thank you so much for sharing it.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
That was mountaineer Neil Johansson, and we'll put some more details for the Schools for the Himalaya project up on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. And this conversation will be available for you shortly as a podcast on there as well and through your podcast feed. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.